So you may remember that the kind of the first real peak of Romans that we hit was chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, where Paul announced what he was going to talk about in that letter, kind of his thesis statement for the book of Romans, where he said, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, right? For it is the power of God. You may remember that. And then he laid out that verse from Habakkuk, where he said, the just by faith shall live. Well, this passage today is the next peak, right? The passage today is really where Paul sums up where he's still going to make a summary at the end of chapter 4, but where he really hits the climax of the whole first four chapters. So this is Romans 3, verses 21 through 31, where he's going to lay out what it means to be just by faith. You may remember that we kind of laid out the structure of the book, that in the first eight chapters, he lays out the gospel under the rubric of the just by faith shall live. And in chapters 1 through 4, he describes what it means to be just by faith. And in then 5 through 8, he describes what he means that the just shall live. What is that life that he's talking about? And so this is the point where he really just lays out what it is to be just by faith. Romans 3, 21 through 31. But now, a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are justified freely by His grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. God presented Him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in His blood. He did this to demonstrate His justice, because in His forbearance He had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate His justice at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Where then is boasting? It is excluded. On what principle? On that of observing the law? No, but on that of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing the law. Is God the God of Jews only? Is He not the God of Gentiles too? Yes, of Gentiles too, since there is only one God who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. Do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. Rather, we uphold the law. The word of God for the people of God. So having laid out that all the world is under the wrath of God, Paul has really just kind of gotten to where he wants to launch from. And so he says in verse 21, but now, contrasting with all that wrath that he's laid out since the beginning of the world, but now the righteousness of God has been made known. Okay? Now, a few weeks ago, I mentioned when we were back at that Romans 1, 16 and 17, that the phrase, the righteousness of God, especially here in Romans, but in other places of the Bible and in the Old Testament, means something more than we would guess. The way that the Old Testament and other Jewish writings use the phrase, the righteousness of God, shows that they were referring not just to the fact that God does the right thing, and not just the fact that God expects us to do the right thing, although those ideas are built in there. But it refers to God's own saving activity in the world. The righteousness of God refers to God Himself showing up in the world to rescue the world and set it back on track to become the perfect, righteous, beautiful expression of himself that he intended when he created the world. When you get your head around that big idea of the righteousness of God, right? And then you see that, oh my goodness, that's like the theme of the entire Bible. That God creates this world that's going to be beautiful, that's going to be righteous, right? In the fullest sense of the world. A world that will be peace and grace, right? And then it's destroyed by sin. And right from day one, back in Genesis 3, it's not really day one, but the beginning, right? Right back in Genesis 3, God says, I'm going to make this right. And then all through the Old Testament, you have this long story spilling out of how is this going to happen? And yet, while that question just is never fully answered, the promise keeps coming back over and over and over again in all sorts of different ways. God saying, I will still make this right. That idea that the world needs to be set right and that God himself will show up breaking in on the world to make it right, that's the righteousness of God. And when you get your head around that, it becomes clear then that when Paul says it has been made known, we're not talking about knowing information. It's not that God has finally told us the secret. That all through the Old Testament is hinted at, and then in the New Testament, God says plainly what he's going to do. Rather, it's made known in the sense of revealed. Revealed in the sense of plainly seen. Plainly seen in the sense of it's happening. This is what Paul is saying. When he says that the righteousness of God has been made known, he's saying that God's saving activity in the world, God showing up to make all things right, because the world has been busy flushing itself down the toilet for millennia, that this moment when God shows up to exert his power to rip the world out of its downward spiral and restore it to what he intended, that is happening. That's what Paul says when he says the righteousness of God has been made known. He's saying that the world has been laid in sin under the wrath of God for as long as humans have been on earth. But now, all of that has been turned around because God has shown up and is making it right. And then he says that while this saving activity doesn't happen through the law, which is what many of the Jews expected, he says that while it doesn't happen through the law itself, together with the prophets, bears witness to what God is actually doing now. Now, Paul's going to return to this idea in verse 31, this idea of this teaching of being just by faith that's actually upheld, agrees with the teaching of the Old Testament. He's going to return to that in verse 31, and then that's actually what chapter 4 is largely going to be about, proving from the Old Testament that the law and the prophets bear witness to this, what he's talking about in this passage. So, having said in verse 21 that God shows up to save the world from his wrath, he then makes three points. First, in 22 through 24, he says that the way that God saves is the same for everyone, Jew and Gentile. Second, in the first part of verse 25, he states how God has shown up to save. And then finally, he explains in the second part of 25 and into 26, why God has done it this way. So, in verses 22 through 24, Paul says that God's activity to save us comes to everyone. That's the main point of what he says in this part, that it comes to everyone the same way, only by faith in Jesus Christ. And Paul stresses this right off. And you'll notice that he's been stressing this over and over and over again. Almost every point he's made so far has been Jew and Gentile. He keeps stressing this because this is the particular part of the gospel, the particular gospel truth, that it comes to both Jew and Gentile in the same way, that Paul is later going to apply to the problem that's going on in the Roman church. He lays out all the gospel at length. He takes 8 chapters, longer than most of his letters, just to lay out the gospel. Because he does want to show them that he can be trusted. Remember, one of his goals here is to let the Roman church trust him in order to support him. But as he lays the gospel out in length, he keeps emphasizing one particular point, that it is by faith for both Jew and Gentile. Because that's the part of the gospel that he's then going to challenge them with, that he's going to kind of poke in the face and say, hey, did you hear what I said about this? Are you living this out? I don't think so. So here, he says that it must be the same for all, because all are in the same boat, which is what he's been arguing for these the first three chapters. All are in the same boat because all have chosen sin. And no one, not even God's own chosen people, are living as his image. You may remember that that came out back in chapter 1, where Paul refers back to the Genesis story. And keeping in mind that idea that man was created to be God's image, right? Only his image, utterly dependent on him for all that he is, but the most glorious thing in the universe, the representation of God himself. But that man rejected that, chose not to be dependent on God, decided to be his own image, and became godless with all the consequences that we saw of that. Because all have chosen sin, and no one is living out as the image of God, that's why people fall short of the glory of God. Okay? That's a phrase that a lot of people have struggled to understand. I've heard people say that, or understand it to mean that we're expected to be as glorious as God, that we're expected to be just as righteous as God, that we're expected to be just as holy as God. And because we're not as good as God, we've fallen short of the glory of God and he should crush us like bugs. Right? That is not what it means. God does not expect us to be like God. He expects us to be utterly dependent on him. It doesn't mean that we're expected to be as perfect as he is. It's a reminder that we were intended to be his representation in the world, his image. Not his equal, but like him. Revealing his glory only partially, but genuinely. His image, but only his image. And since all of us have rejected that role, and we've chosen to be independent sinners rather than dependent images of his glory, we're all in the same boat, and Paul can say that all are justified in the same way. So this word, justified, right? It's a word taken from the law courts, right? Paul here is using a metaphor taken from the court, and it refers not to being innocent in and of yourself, but becoming officially innocent because the judge says so. Okay? Now, typically, in an actual law court, whether ancient or modern, a judge declares a person to be in the right because they deserve to be declared in the right. But Paul says that this analogy to the court fails in this important point because we do not deserve to be declared in the right, but we are declared to be in the right freely by his grace. Because God makes a free gift to us out of his goodness. But while this declaration of blamelessness is not based on our blamelessness, all the same, it is based on something. And Paul here says that it is based on the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. Now the word here, redemption, like a lot of other things, is argued about viciously, but it can be used vaguely for just rescue. But usually, And over again in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, usually it meant buying, it usually had a very specific meaning of buying someone out of slavery by paying their debt. Most commonly, people ended up in slavery either kind of by warfare or by being in debt. Right? And those of you who are familiar with the Old Testament can kind of maybe call to mind a bunch of those laws. When somebody was in debt to somebody, the person who was owed the money could have the person or their family sold into a temporary slavery until such time as the debt was paid. Okay? And so when you pay that debt, the person is released from slavery. And that was called redemption. Okay? In the same way that you have your empty can of Coke, right? And you had to put a nickel down when you bought that can of Coke. And you forget all about it because we do it all the time and don't think about it. But when you paid for the Coke, fair and square, it's your Coke. And then when you tried to leave the store, they said, hey, wait a minute, you got my can. And you say, what? I want that can back. You're not walking out of the store without my can, right? And you say, tell you what, you give me something. Maybe your license or your first child. And when you bring my can back, you can have your kid back. And you say, what? Okay, a nickel. Right? And what do we call it? You go to that little shack beside the road, and it's called a redemption center. Right? I love that term. Right? Someday we're going to have a redemption center. So, so the word redemption here is speaking about the fact that the way that God delivers any sinner out from under the wrath that he deserves is by Jesus Christ paying the debt of the sinner. And with the penalty paid, God can then, on that basis, not on the basis of the person's innocence or good intentions or relative morality or whatever it is that they put their trust in, on the basis that Jesus paid what they should have paid, can declare him just, free from wrath. In this verse, there is the critical, critical idea that I think many, many, many well-intentioned, faithful, real good Christians don't understand. And if we don't understand it, certainly the world that we're trying to bring the gospel to doesn't understand. And is the critical idea that the judgment is not about sorting out the wicked from the good. The judgment is not about sorting out the wicked and the good. Because we're all wicked. And the reason that doesn't compute with us is we don't know what it is to not be wicked. It is not a question of under wrath or justified. All are wicked, all are under wrath, but then some of those who are under wrath are delivered out of that wrath. Not a single person in history has been or ever will be declared righteous by God except that he or she was first condemned under the wrath of God. Righteousness, justification, being innocent, being right with God, presupposes that you have already been condemned under his wrath. Then in verse 25, we have more information of just how God accomplished this redemption out of wrath. He's already intimated in that word redemption that Jesus paid the price of the guilty person's freedom. But how did he do that? And the answer in verse 25 is that Jesus paid that price by dying a violent death. When Paul says that God presented him, the idea is set him up to be something or made him. Okay? And the idea is that Jesus becomes something in order to pay the price. He doesn't just simply remain who he is in his own little bubble and do something for us out of that bubble. He doesn't whip out his wallet and pay the price. He himself became something. And what did he become? Well, the word that Paul uses, actually, in the Greek, refers either to a means of forgiveness or a place of forgiveness. And this word, because it could mean the means of forgiveness, was used to refer to the actual sacrifice offered up for forgiveness. And that's the idea of the word that the NIV chooses to go with when it translates a sacrifice of atonement. But the word that Paul actually uses in the Greek Old Testament that Paul knew and that his readers knew, okay? The word that Paul uses here was the word that was used over and over again for what we call the mercy seat. Anybody remember what the mercy seat was? I know that some people do. And go ahead and just raise hands. I'm just basically curious. Who knows what the mercy seat in the Old Testament was? John Thorpe, you're not being honest. Right. Okay. No, I'm genuinely surprised because I thought this is something that basically most people would. The mercy seat. What is the mercy seat? No, what's the mercy seat? The mercy seat is the name of the mercy seat. Yeah, okay, so you have the temple. Whether we're talking about the tabernacle or we're talking about the temple that was built, right? There were these two rooms. The outside room, right, where the priests would come in and do their things, and there was showbread and a candle and all that stuff. And then there was the inside room called the Holy of Holies. And no one ever went in the Holy of Holies. The high priest alone was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies one time a year. He'd actually go in twice. On that one day, he kind of had to go in and then out and then go back in. So he actually goes in twice a year, but no one will ever tell you that because it's all on the same day, part of the same ceremony. So inside the Holy of Holies, there was the Ark of the Covenant, right? That golden box where they kept the tablets that Moses had gotten from God on the mountain, and there was also a jar of manna and Aaron's rod that had budded. So you have this Ark of the Covenant, and then the cover of it had these two statues of cherubim that basically put their wings up together, and I should have put a picture of this up, right? And had their wings come up and cover over so that on top of the Ark of the Covenant, there was this empty space. And that is where God dwelt in the temple. Sometimes there would appear in that space the Shekinah glory, the physical manifestation of the very presence of God. And that cover of the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant was all about the requirements, the demands that God put on the people. But then it was covered over with God's gracious presence. And that mercy seat where God sits in mercy to forgive his people, that's where the blood of the most important sacrifices, not all of them, but the most important sacrifices, the blood was brought into the Holy of Holies and sprinkled there on the mercy seat. The mercy seat was the very center of the entire temple system. The mercy seat was the place where God was most directly present and where the blood of a sacrifice was brought to be forgiven. And Paul says that God made Jesus the mercy seat. So the idea with this word is that what God did with Jesus to pay the price was the same thing as what was going on in the Old Testament sacrifices. Now, the whole idea of the Old Testament sacrifice system was not like the pagan world around it. Some people who like to stress that Israel was no different from their neighbors will point out that what they did with the animal, the way they sacrificed, the way they built their temples, the way there was all exactly the same as all the other cultures around it. There are a lot of parallels. But what the Israelites thought they were doing with the sacrifice was markedly different from the cultures around them. All the pagan world around them, the idea was that you could buy your God off with a gift. You could bribe the judge. Right now I'm reading Homer's Iliad about the sack of Troy. And all over the place, the warriors are trying to bribe the gods. The gods keep switching sides, right? And whoever offers up the bigger ox, oh, the gods, oh, yeah, okay, we'll go over here, right? Sacrifices were, what can I give my God so that he'll do what I want? But in the Old Testament, the idea was that the sinner identified himself with the sacrificial animal. Okay? Before the sacrifice, the sinner would lay his hands on the animal, basically saying, "This is me." And in that is the acknowledgement that death is the appropriate punishment. When the Old Testament believer brought the sacrifice to the temple, he was saying, "I am guilty. I ought to die." And there's the recognition that the animal is being allowed to die in the person's place. Now, that raises a really kind of obvious question. Since an animal is worth so much less than the person's guilt, why does this work? And the very simple answer is, it didn't. The Old Testament sacrifices did not bring real forgiveness. They were simply a placeholder, a token, representing the already settled in heaven fact of Jesus' sacrifice to come. Jesus, whose worth is infinitely more than what our sin deserves. And the words that Paul is piling up here with justify and redemption and then this word for the mercy seat, he's saying that Jesus paid our debt was by dying as our substitute. Dying in our place, taking our punishment. And then in the second half of 25 and 26, Paul's eager to point out that this whole system, the system of Jesus dying a violent death as a sacrifice in order to pay the price of God's wrath on our sin, so that we, by trusting what God did in Jesus, can step out from under God's wrath and be declared just. This whole system is done in this way in order to demonstrate God's justice. Has anyone here ever thought that God is unjust? And if you, who love Him, not having seen Him, are tempted to think that He is unjust, what does the world think? Paul writes, "Because in His forbearance He had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished." When we hear that God left sins unpunished, we might be tempted to think, "Oh, phew, that's good news." But what if you're the victim of somebody else's sin? If the world is being flushed down the toilet, if the world is literally being made a living hell because people are nasty to each other, it is not a good thing that God leaves sins unpunished. The idea here is that it was necessary to prove that God is just because anyone looking at history would conclude that God is not just. You look at history and you see people being wicked and getting away with it. Think of your stereotypical CEO of a pharmaceutical company. Think of your typical, you know, whatever you want to picture, powerful person who does what he wants with impunity. The Old Testament, particularly Psalms, frequently talks about this, that the wicked seem to get away with it. They're horrible people, and they die plump and happy with their kids all around them. The Old Testament is full of God's people complaining that God appears to ignore the sins of the wicked. A judge who ignores guilt is an unjust judge. But here Paul is saying that God only appeared to pass over sins. And he did that only so that he could then, in the fullness of time, demonstrate his justice at the cross. The cross is the proof that God really does punish sin. And then Paul makes this profound conclusion that this system of saving up the punishment of all the sin of the world, seeming to ignore it for millennia, saving it all up, just building this bigger and bigger and bigger account in order to then drop it all on Jesus, allows God to be both just and the justifier. It allows him to be just in that God remains holy, punishing the guilt that should be punished. No one can look at Jesus' violent death on the cross and say that God overlooked sin. God is justified in that he punishes sin like he says. But it also turns out that he's the justifier, the one who can deliver people from his wrath and thereby faithfully fulfill his promises of restoring the world with humanity at its head as his image. Restoring the world with humanity as its head to the peace, the glory, and the beauty that he has always intended for it. The Old Testament shows over and over again God to be the wrathful divine warrior before whom all wickedness quakes. But the Old Testament also showed him to be the good shepherd, rescuing his people, stepping in to take them onto his own shoulders and deliver them. Now, these two images, that's no problem at all if God's people are righteous. But how can he be both if his people are wicked? Well, this is what Paul's talking about. By the violent death of Jesus as our substitute. And Paul is laying out that is what it is to be just by faith. And it is that person that he's going to say can step into the life in chapters 5 through 8. So having laid out who the just by faith are in verses 21 through 26, in 27 through 31, he makes two points based on this. And this is just going to be very brief. First, in 27 and 28, he says that we are all condemned, and Jesus does it freely for us, since it has nothing to do with the law and everything to do with our putting our trust in what God is doing with Jesus. That because that's how God does it, then God's saving activity in the world is happening through faith, not through obedience to the law. That's the first kind of conclusion that he draws out of this. And then the second one, in verses 29 and 30, he says that since we are all condemned, and Jesus does it freely for us, completely apart from the law, then there is absolutely no difference between Jews and Gentiles, once both have been condemned and then justified. And then in verse 31, Paul says that this teaching, that it is just by faith for Jew and Gentile, does not disagree with the law, but actually says the same thing that the law itself says. And that's what he's going to go on to show, to demonstrate from the Old Testament in chapter 4. In the very short six verses of 21 through 26, Paul packs the truth of Jesus' sacrifice and our salvation. And it is actually really kind of mind-boggling how briefly and compactly Paul covers what God did in Jesus to save us from wrath. And as we go on in Romans, we're going to see that Paul, after dealing with the heart of the gospel in six verses, he's going to spend a lot more time and attention. He's going to write at length about how this salvation should lead to a transformed inner life and to a radically different behavior out there in the world. And sometimes we evangelicals, we are so passionate about the experience of stepping into the cross and really experiencing what it is to be just by faith that we can lose sight of the rest of the gospel. we can be so eager to hold on to the glory of that moment of conversion when we first understood what Jesus did for us at the cross, that we can actually neglect to go on to what the cross makes possible. So Paul here has just stated as clearly as possible and beautifully what it is to be justified, to be redeemed, to be saved, to be bought out from under God's wrath. And it is precious, precious to us. But as we go on through the rest of Romans, we need to listen to what Paul is going to say that should mean for us.